of the dark figure that she'd somehow recognized as a queen, and the cobwebs that had flowed from the queen's hair remained vivid, haunting her still.
"I don't know what to do, if I should pray for forgiveness or what," she said.
"Oh, fuck it," Janice Coates had advised her. "You can do what you want since the Pope's not here to make a ruling, but I'm just going to keep doing my best. What else is there to do, honestly, that we know for sure can make a difference?" This had been another crowd pleaser. The question, however, what the fuck had happened, was renewed again and again, without lasting satisfaction. At one meeting, it was at least 3 months after what Janice Coates liked to call the Great Displacement, a new attendee crept in and settled on a 50-pound bag of fertilizer at the back of the room. She kept her head down during the lively discussion of life as it was now lived, and news of a wonderful discovery at the local UPS shipping office. 9 boxes of Luna Pads, which were reusable sanitary napkins.
"No more cutting up t-shirts to stuff in my underwear at that time of the month," Nell Seeger exulted. "Hallelujah!"
Toward the end of the meeting, talk turned, as it always did, to those things they missed. These discussions almost always occasioned tears for the boys and men, but most of the women said they felt at least temporarily unburdened. Lighter.
"Are we done, ladies?" Blanche asked on this particular day. "Does anyone have a burning desire to share before we get back to work?"
A small hand went up, the fingers dusted with many different colors of chalk.
"Yes, dear," Blanche said. "You're new, aren't you? And very short. Would you care to stand?"
"Welcome," the women chorused, turning to see. Nana Geary got to her feet. She brushed her hands down the front of her shirt, which was now very worn and raggedy at the sleeves, but still her favorite.
"My mom doesn't know I'm here," she said, "so I hope no one will tell her."
"Honey," said Dorothy Harper, "this is like Vegas. What goes on in women's hour stays in women's hour."
This brought a murmur of laughter, but the little girl in the faded pink t-shirt did not even smile.
"I just want to say I miss my daddy. I went into Pearson's barber shop and found some of his aftershave, Dracar Noir, it's called, and I smelled it, and it made me cry."
The front of the supermarket was dead silent except for a few sniffles. It would turn out later that Nana hadn't been the only one to visit the aftershave shelves at Pearson's.
"I guess that's all," Nana said. "Just, I miss him. And I wish I could see him again."
They applauded her. Nana sat down and put her hands over her face. 4. Our place was no utopia. There were tears, more than a few arguments, and during the first summer, a murderous suicide that shocked them all, mostly because it was utterly senseless. Maura Dunbarton, another refugee from the dueling correctional of the previous world, strangled Kaylee Rawlings, then took her own life. It was Coates who fetched Lila to see. Maura was hanging from a noose knotted to the rusty crossbar of a backyard swing set. Kaylee had been discovered in the room the lovers had shared, dead in her sleeping bag, her face gray and the sclera of her open eyes filigreed with hemorrhages. She had been strangled, then stabbed at least a dozen times. Maura had left a note, penciled on a scrap of envelope. "This world is different, but I am the same. You will be better off without me. I have killed Kaylee for no reason. She did not aggravate me or start anything. I still loved her, like in prison. I know she was useful to you. I could not help myself. It came on me to kill her, so I did. I was sorry I did it afterwards. Maura."
"What do you think?" asked Lila.
Janice said, "I think it's a mystery like everything else here. I think it's a goddamn shame that when it came on to the crazy bitch to kill someone, she picked the only one in our place who understood how to wire a circuit and make it hot. Now I'll hold her legs while you climb up and cut her down."
Coates walked over and, without any ceremony, wrapped her arms around Maura Dunbarton's short legs.
She looked over at Lila. Come on, then. Don't make me wait. Smells like she loaded her pants. Suicide is so glamorous.
They buried both the killer and her hapless victim outside the sagging ring of fencing that surrounded the prison. It was summer again by then, bright and hot, with chiggers popping around the grass tops. Coates spoke a few words about Kaylee's contribution to the community and Maura's puzzling act of homicide. A chorus of the children sang Amazing Grace. Their little girl voices made Lila weep. She had salvaged a number of photographs of Jared and Clint from their home, and she sometimes attended the meetings, but as time passed, her son and husband began to seem less real. At night, in her tent, Lila preferred to camp out as long as the weather was clement, she wound her crank flashlight and scanned their faces in the beam. Who would Jared become? There was still that softness at the edges of his face, even in the most recent of the pictures. It hurt her not to know. She looked at her husband's image, his wry smile and graying hair, and missed him, though not as much as she missed Jer. Her suspicions of Clint on that horrible last day and night embarrassed her. Her lies and the pointless fears made her ashamed. But Lila also found herself regarding her husband differently now that she saw him through the lens of memory. She thought about how carefully he'd bricked up his past, the way he'd used his authority as a doctor to bolster the concealment and ward her off. Had Clint thought that only he could handle that kind of pain? That it was too much for her little mind and puny spirit to absorb? Or was it a kind of egotism masquerading as strength? She knew men were taught, primarily by other men, of course, that they were to keep their pain to themselves. But she also knew marriage was supposed to undo some of that teaching. That hadn't been the case with Clint. And there was the pool. It still made her mad. And how he'd quit his job without a moment's notice all those years ago. And a million tiny decisions in between, taken by him and for her to live with. It made her feel like a Stepford wife, even with her husband in some other world. Owls hooted in the dark, and dogs run feral after who knew how many canine generations, howled. Lila zipped the flap of her tent. The moon shone blue through the yellow fabric. Remembering all that domestic soap opera depressed her. Her parts and his parts, back and forth. He slams one door, she slams the other. The histrionic crap she had always looked down on in other people's marriages. Condescension, thy name was Lila, she thought, and had to laugh. 5. The hedges that once framed the prison had flourished into dense mounds. Lila entered through the gouge in the foliage that Coates and the other women who had awakened there had hacked out. Entry to the prison itself was through a hole in the south wall. Something, Lila was guessing the industrial gas stove in the kitchen, had exploded, blowing out the concrete as easily as a child huffing out a birthday candle. Going in, she half expected to emerge in yet another place. A white beach, a cobbled thoroughfare, a rocky mountaintop, Oz. But when she arrived, it was only a wing of former cells. The walls were half crumbled, some of the barred doors blown right off their hinges. She thought that the detonation must have been a doozy. Weeds grew from the floor and mold crawled across the ceiling. She walked through the ruined wing and emerged into the central hall of the prison, what Clint called Broadway. Things looked better here. Lila followed the red line painted down the middle of the corridor. The various gates and barriers were unlocked, the wire-reinforced windows that gave onto the prison's facilities, cafeteria, library, the booth, were fogged over. Where Broadway reached the front doors, there was another section that showed signs of an explosion. Busted cinder blocks, dusty shards of glass. The steel door separating the entry area from the prison proper crumpled inward. Lila skirted the junk. Farther down Broadway, she passed the open door to the staff lounge. Inside, mushrooms sprouted from the wall-to-wall carpeting. The air reeked of enthusiastic plant life. She eventually came to Clint's office. The corner window was blown out, and a mass of overgrown shrubbery poured in, flowering with white blooms.
A rat was rummaging around in the stuffing of a torn couch cushion. It gawked at Lila for a moment and darted for the safety of a pile of crumbled drywall. The Hockney print behind her husband's desk hung askew, cocked at 11 and 5. She straightened it. The picture showed a plain, sandy-colored building with rows of identically curtained windows. At ground level, the building had 2 doors. One door was blue, the other red, examples of Hockney's famous colors, bright like the feelings aroused by good memories, even if the memories themselves were thin, and the interpretive possibilities had appealed to Lila. She had given it to Clint all those years ago, thinking that he might point to it and say to his patients, "See? Nothing is closed to you. There are doors to a healthier, happier life." The irony was as glaring as the metaphor. Clint was in another world. Jared was in another world. For all she knew, one or both of them might be dead. The Hockney print belonged to the rats and mold and weeds of this world. It was a broken world, emptied out and forgotten, but it was the one they had. It was, God save us, our place. Lila left the office and retraced her steps through the dead world of the prison to the hole in the foliage. She wanted out. 6. Throughout those months, more women continued to appear from what James Brown had once called a man's, man's, man's world. They reported that in dueling, when they'd fallen asleep, the Aurora crisis was still fresh. There, only 2 or 3 days had passed. The violence and confusion and desperation they talked about seemed unreal to the earlier arrivals in this new place. More, it seemed almost unimportant. The women of this world had their own problems and concerns. One of them was the weather. Summer waned. After the fall, the winter would follow. With the aid of manuals from the library and overseen by the unlikely personage of Magda Dubcek, the widow of a contractor, not to mention the mother of Lila's pool boy, they were able to finish some of the work Kaylee had begun before being murdered by her crazy ex-girlfriend. Magda's late husband had taught her quite a bit about electrical work. "My husband, he was telling me what he was doing every day. And look, here is the live wire, Magda, and look, here is the ground wire," and so on. "I listen. He never knew it. He thought he was just talking to some stupid wall, but I listen." At this, Magda paused to make a sly face that reminded Lila, heartbreakingly, of Anton. "Well, for the first 500 times, I listen anyway." With power scavenged from a handful of solar panels that had survived the years of neglect, they were able to create a limited electrical grid for at least a few of the high-ground houses. Regular cars were useless. It was impossible to determine how long this version of their world had spun unattended, but the state of the parked cars was a clue that it had been enough time for water and moisture to have its way with engines. A car stored in a still-standing garage might have been salvageable, except there wasn't a drop of gasoline anywhere that hadn't destabilized or evaporated. What the women did find was a small fleet of well-preserved solar-powered golf carts in the equipment shed at the country club. Once they were recharged, they started right up. Women drove them up and down streets that had been cleared of trees and foliage. Like the Shopwell, the Olympia Diner had stood up to the passage of time remarkably well, and Rita Coombs, once the wife of Terry, reopened it on a barter basis, cooking with an old portable wood stove that a gang of women had helped haul up from the Coombs' basement. "I always wanted to try my hand at running a restaurant," she explained to Lila, "but Terry never wanted me to work. He said it would make him worry. Terry could never understand how damn boring it was to be a piece of china in a hutch." She said this in a light way, but kept her gaze averted in an expression of what Lila read as shame, a shame that came from being happy to have something of her own. Lila hoped Rita would get over it, and thought she would, eventually. There were a lot of them that felt changed, but in a way that might also contain that tincture of shame, as if they were playing hooky. Women like Magda and Rita, who suddenly found themselves in demand and flourishing in the light of a new world. As those unmarked weeks peeled away, they discussed not just what they missed, but also some of what they did not miss. The leaves changed as they did in the old world, but to Lila their colors seemed more vibrant and longer-lasting. She was in Mrs. Ransom's garden one day in what felt like late October, picking pumpkins for the schoolgirls to carve. Old Essie, seated on a bench in the shade, watched her. Next to the bench was a rusty shopping cart full of things Essie had picked up, as if trying to restock her new life from memories of the old one. A radio, a cell phone, a heap of clothes, a dog collar, a calendar from 2007, a bottle of something that had no label but might have been maple syrup once upon a time, and a trio of dolls. She liked to follow Lila when she saw Lila in her big straw hat rolling the wheelbarrow piled high with gardening implements. The old lady was silent at first, and shied away if anyone came near her, but as the weeks passed, she began to relax, at least around Lila. Sometimes she would even talk, although Lila guessed she'd never been a great conversationalist, even in her prime.
"Things are better now," Essie said once. "I have my very own house."
She looked fondly down at the dolls in her lap.
"My girls like it. Their names are Jingle, Pingle, and Ringle."
Lila had asked her on that occasion what her last name was.
"Once it was Wilcox," Essie said, "but now it's Estabrook. I have taken back my maidenhood name, just like that Elaine woman. This place is better than the old place, and not just because I have my maidenhood name and my very own house. It smells sweeter."
Today, Essie seemed to have slipped back inside herself a bit. When Lila tried to engage her in conversation, Essie shook her head, made violent shooing motions in Lila's direction, and rummaged in her rusty shopping cart. From it, she removed an ancient Philco table radio and started tossing it from hand to hand, which was perfectly okay with Lila. Let her play hot potato to her heart's content if that was what eased her mind. As she was getting ready to break for lunch, Janice Coates rode up on a bicycle.
"Chief," she said to Lila, "a word."
"I'm not the chief anymore, Janice. Don't you read the dueling doings? I'm just another local."
Coates was undeterred.
"Fine, but you need to know there's people disappearing. 3 of them now. Too many to be a coincidence. We need someone to look into this situation."
Lila examined the pumpkin she had just torn from a vine. The top was bright orange, but the underside was black and rotten. She dropped it with a thud in the tilled earth. "Talk to the redevelopment committee, or bring it up in the next meeting. I'm retired."
"Come on, Lila."
Coates, perched on the seat of the bike, crossed her bony arms.
"Don't give me that bullshit. You're not retired. You're depressed."
Feelings, Lila thought. Men almost never wanted to talk about them. Women almost always did. It could get boring. That came as a surprise. It came to her that she might have to reevaluate some of her resentments about Clint's stoicism.
"I can't, Janice."
Lila walked down the row of pumpkins. "I'm sorry."
"I'm depressed, too," said Janice. "I may never see my daughter again. I think of her first thing in the morning and last thing at night, every damn day. And I miss calling my brothers, but I'm not about to let that..."
There was a dull thump and a soft cry from behind them. Lila glanced around. The radio lay on the grass next to Jingle, Pingle, and Ringle. The dolls stared up at the cloudless sky with their flat, beatific expressions. Essie was gone. There was a single brown moth where she had been. It fluttered aimlessly for a moment, then flew up and away, trailed faintly by the smell of fire. Chapter 3 1.
"Holy fucking shit!"
Eric Blass cried. He was sitting on the ground and staring up.
"Did you see that?"
"I'm still seeing it," John replied, looking at the flock of moths winging above the tennis courts and toward the high school.
"And smelling it."
He had given Eric his lighter, since it was Eric's idea, also so he could semi-plausibly put it all on the kid if anyone found out. Eric had squatted, flicked the Zippo alight, and applied it to the edge of the cocoon in the littered den filled with junk. The cocoon had gone up in a crackling flash,
as if it had contained gunpowder instead of a crazy homeless lady. The stench was immediate and sulfuric. It was like God himself had cut the cheese. Old Essie had sat upright, not that you could see anything more than the outline of her, and seemed to twist toward them. For an instant, her features had clarified, black and silver like a photo negative, and Don had seen her lips rolling back into a snarl. In another beat, there was nothing left of her. The fireball rose to a height of 4 feet, seeming to revolve as it did so. Then the fireball had turned into moths, hundreds of them. Of the cocoon or a skeleton, there was no sign, and the grass where old Essie had been lying wasn't so much as charred. It wasn't that kind of fire, Don thought. If it had have been, we would be baked. Eric got to his feet. His face was very white, and his eyes were frantic. What was that? What just happened? I don't have a fucking clue, Don said. Those blowtorch brigades, or whatever they call themselves, have there been any reports from them of burning cocoons that turned into flying bugs? Not that I know of, but maybe they're not reporting it. Yeah, maybe. Eric licked his lips. Yeah, there's no reason why she'd be different. No, there wasn't any reason why old Essie would be different from every other sleeping woman in the world. But Don could think of one reason why things in dueling might be different. Things might be different here because there was a special woman here, one who slept without growing a cocoon around her, and who woke up again. Come on, Don said. We've got work to do on Ellendale Street, bitch bags to count, names to write down. This here, this never happened. Right, partner? Right. Absolutely. You're not gonna talk about it, are you? Jesus, no. Good. But I might talk about it, Don thought. Not to Terry Coombs, though. It had only taken Don a couple of days to come to the conclusion that the man was next door to useless. What did you call it? A figurehead. And he seemed to have a drinking problem, which was truly pathetic. People who couldn't control their urges repulsed Don. That guy Frank Geary, though, the one Terry had appointed his chief deputy, that one was a thinking cat. And he was keenly interested in the Evie Black woman. He'd have her sprung soon, if not already. He was the one to talk to about this, if talking had to be done. But he needed to think about it first. Very carefully. Don? They were back in the truck. Yeah, kid? Did she see us? It seemed like she saw us. No, said Don. She didn't see nothing, just exploded. Don't be a pussy, Junior. 2. Terry said he wanted to go home and think about their next move. Frank, who was pretty sure the acting chief's next move would be lying down to sleep it off, said that was a good idea. He saw Terry to his front door, then drove directly to the sheriff's office. There he found Lenny Mars pacing circles with a laptop in her hands. There was a crust of white powder around her nostrils. Her cheeks were colored a hectic red. Her eyes were bleary and sunken. From the laptop came the all-too-familiar sounds of chaos. Hi, Pete! She had been calling him Pete since yesterday. Frank didn't bother correcting her. If he did, she'd remember he was Frank for a few minutes, then revert to Pete. Short-term memory loss was common among the women who were still awake. Their frontal lobes were melting like butter in a hot pan. What are you watching?
YouTube vids, she said, not slowing her circuit of the office. I can watch at my desk, I know. Gertrude's screen is much bigger, but every time I sit down, I start to float away. Walking is better.
Gotcha. What's on? Not that he really needed an update. Frank knew what was going on. Bad things.
Clips from Al Jazeera. All the news networks are going crazy, but Al Jazeera is absolutely shitting themselves. The whole Mideast is on fire. Oil, you know. Oil wells. At least no nukes yet, but somebody over there will pop one eventually, don't you think?
I don't know. Lenny, I wonder if you could look something up for me. I tried on my phone and couldn't get anywhere. I guess prison personnel's pretty cagey about their personal info. Lenny was walking faster now, still staring at her laptop, which she held out in front of her like a chalice. She stumbled over a chair, almost fell, righted herself, and forged onward.
The Shias are fighting the Sunnis, and ISIL is fighting them both. Al Jazeera had a panel of commentators on, and they seem to think it's because the women are gone. They say that without females to protect, though their idea of protection sure isn't mine, some central psychological underpinning of Judaism and Islam is gone. Like both of those things are the same. Basically still blaming the women, even after they've gone to sleep. Bonkers, huh? In England?
Enough news of the world, Frank thought. He clapped his hands repeatedly in front of Lenny's face.
I need you to do your job for a minute, hon. Could you do that for me?
She snapped to attention.
Absolutely. What do you need, Pete?
Terry asked me to get an address for Lawrence Hicks. He's the assistant warden up at Correctional. Can you find that for me?
Walk in the park, piece of cake, can of corn. Got all their phone numbers and addresses, in case there's trouble up there, you know.
But it didn't turn out to be a walk in the park, after all. Not in Lenny's current state. Frank waited patiently as she sat at her desk, first trying one file and backing out, then another, then a third, shaking her head and cursing the computer as people did even when it was their own fault. Once she started to nod off and he saw a fine white thread spinning out of her ear. He clapped his hands again in front of her nose.
Concentrate, Lenny, okay? This could be important.
Her head jerked up. The thread snapped off, floated, disappeared. She gave him a loopy smile.
Roger that. Hey, remember that night we went line dancing at Halls of Ivy over in Coughlin, and they kept playing that boot scootin' boogie?
Frank had no idea what she was talking about.
I sure do.
Lawrence Hicks. Address. She finally got it. 64 Clarence Court on the south side of town. Just about as far from the prison as you could get and still be a dueling resident. Thanks, Lenny. Better get some coffee.
I think I'll settle for Colombian marching powder instead of Colombian roast.
Works better.
God bless the Griner brothers.
The phone rang. Lenny grabbed the receiver.
Police?
For about 3 seconds, she listened, then hung up.
They keep calling to ask, is it true that there's a woman up at the prison, blah, blah, blah. Do I look like the newspaper?
She gave him a desperately unhappy smile.
I don't know why I bother staying awake. I'm just postponing the inevitable.
He bent down and rubbed her shoulder with his fingertips. Didn't know he was going to do it until it was done. Hang in. There might be a miracle waiting around the next bend in the road. You won't know until you get there. Lenny started to cry.
Thanks, Dave. That's a nice thing to say.
I'm a nice man, Frank said, who did try to be nice, but found that it wasn't always possible. In the long run, he suspected niceness didn't pull the plow. Frank didn't like that. It didn't give him any pleasure. He wasn't sure Elaine had ever grasped that he didn't actually enjoy losing his temper. But he saw how it was. Someone had to pull the plow, and in dueling, that was him. He left, feeling sure that the next time he saw Lenny Mars, she would be in a cocoon. What some of the deputies had started calling bitch bags. He didn't approve of the term, but he didn't stop them. That was Terry's job. He was the chief, after all. 3. Behind the wheel of Unit 4 once more, Frank got on the horn to Reed Barrows and Vern Rangel in Unit 3. When Vern answered, Frank asked if they were still in the Tremaine Street area.
"Yup," said Vern, "and making fast work of it. Not many sleepers in this neighborhood once you get past the chief's place. You should see all the for sale signs. Guess the so-called economic recovery never made it this far."
"Uh-huh. Listen, you two. Terry says he wants to locate Chief Norcross and her son."
"Their house is empty," Vern said. "We already checked it. I told Terry that. I think maybe he's been..."
Vern must have suddenly realized that what he was saying was going out over the air.
"He's been, you know, a little overworked."
"No, he knows that," Frank said. "He wants you to start checking the empty houses, too. I seem to remember there's a whole cul-de-sac that's unfinished a little further up. If you find them, just say howdy and move on, but then get in touch with me right away, all right?" Reed took the mic.
"I think if Lila's not awake, Frank, Then she must have wandered off into the woods or something. Otherwise, she'd be in a cocoon at home or at the sheriff's office. Look, I'm just passing on what Terry told me. Frank certainly wasn't going to tell those two what seemed obvious to him. Norcross was a step ahead. If his wife was still awake, she'd still be in charge. Therefore, the doc had phoned his son and told the kid to move Lila to a safer place. It was another indication that the man was up to mischief. Frank was sure they wouldn't be far from home. "Where is Terry, anyway?" Reed asked. "I dropped him off at his house," Frank said. "Jesus," Reed sounded disgusted. "I hope he's up to this job, Frank. I really do." "Can that talk," Frank said. "Remember, you're on the air."
"Roger that," Reed said. "We'll start checking the empty houses further up Tremaine. That section's on our list, anyway."
"Great. Unit 4 is clear." Frank racked the mic and headed for Clarence Court. He badly wanted to know where Lila Norcross and her son were. They could be the levers he needed to end the situation bloodlessly, but that was second on his list. It was time to get some answers about Ms. Eve Black. 4. Jared answered on the second ring.
"This is the CDC, dueling branch, epidemiologist Jared Norcross speaking."
"No need for that, Jer," Clint said. "I'm alone in my office. Is Mary okay?"
"Yeah, for now. She's walking around in the backyard. She says the sun perks her up."
Clint felt vague alarm and told himself not to be such an old biddy. Privacy fences, lots of trees. She'd be okay back there. It wasn't as if Terry and his new second-in-command could send out a drone or a helicopter.
"I don't think she can stay awake much longer, Dad. I don't know how she's managed it this long."
"Me either.
And I'm not sure why Mom wanted us up here anyway. There's some furniture, but the bed is hard."
He paused. "Guess that sounds pretty whiny, huh, with all that's going on?"
"People tend to focus on the small things to keep the big ones from overwhelming them," Clint said.
"And your mom was right, Jer."
"You don't really think a blowtorch brigade is going to start up in dueling, do you?"
Clint thought of the title of an old novel, It Can't Happen Here. The point being that anything could happen anywhere. But no, it wasn't a dueling blowtorch brigade he was currently worried about.
"There are things you don't know," Clint said. "But since other people do, or suspect, at least, I'll bring you up to speed tonight."
After that, I might not get many more chances, he thought.
"I'll bring you and Mary dinner. Double hamburg, double mush from Pizza Wagon sound okay? Assuming they're still open for business?"
"Sounds awesome," Jared said. "How about a clean shirt, too?"
"It will have to be an officer's blue shirt," Clint said. "I don't want to go by the house."
Jared didn't reply at first. Clint was about to ask if he was still there when his son said, "Please tell me you're just being paranoid."
"I'll explain everything when I get there. Keep Mary awake. Remind her she can't eat pizza through a cocoon."
"I'll do that."
"And Jared?"
"Yeah?"
"The cops aren't keeping me apprised of their strategy for dealing with the local situation. I'm not their favorite person right now. But if I were them, I'd be grid-searching the town and keeping a master list of all the sleeping women, plus their locations. Terry Coombs might not be smart enough or on top of things enough to think of that, but I believe there's a man who's working with him who is."
"Okay.
If they show up where you are, keep quiet and... Is there a storage space in that house? Other than the cellar, I mean?"
"Not sure. I haven't exactly searched it, but I think there's an attic."
"If you see cops on the street, you should get everyone up there."
"Jesus, really? You're kind of freaking me out here, Pop. I'm not sure I'm following you. Why shouldn't I let the cops find Mom and Mrs. Ransom and Molly? They're not burning women here, right?"
"No, they're not, but it could still be dangerous, Jared. For you, for Mary, and especially for your mother. Like I said, the police aren't very happy with me right now. It has to do with the woman I told you guys about, the one who's different. I don't want to get into the details now, but you have to believe me. Can you get them up to the attic or not?"
"Yeah. I hope I don't have to, but yeah."
"Good. I love you, and I'll be there soon, hopefully bearing pizza. But first, he thought, I'm going to take another run at Evie Black. 5. When Clint got to A-Wing, carrying a folding chair from the common room under one arm, Jeanette was standing by the door to the shower and the delousing station, having a conversation with an individual who didn't exist. It seemed to be some kind of convoluted dope deal. She said she wanted the good stuff, the blues, because they mellowed Damien out. Evie was at the bars of her cell, watching this with what appeared to be sympathy, although with the mentally unbalanced, you could never be sure. And speaking of the mentally unbalanced, Angel was sitting on the bunk in a nearby cell with her lowered head propped on her hands and her hair hiding her face. She looked up briefly at Clint, said, "Hello, cocksucker," and lowered her head again. "I know where you get it," Jeanette was saying to the invisible pusher, "and I know you can get it now. It's not like they close at midnight. Do me a favor, okay? Please? Please? I don't want Damien in one of those moods. And Bobby's teething, too. My head can't take it." "Jeanette," Clint said. "Bobby?" She blinked at him. "Oh, Dr. Norcross." Her face seemed attenuated now, as if all muscles there had already gone to sleep and were only waiting for her stubborn brain to follow. It made Clint think of an old joke. Horse walks into a bar, and the bartender says, "Hey, buddy, why the long face?" Clint wanted to explain to her why he'd ordered the officers to disable the payphones and apologize for preventing her from calling her son to make sure the boy was all right. He wasn't certain, however, that Jeanette would be able to comprehend him at this point, and if she did, if it would achieve anything or only distress her further. The liberties that Clint had taken with the lives of the prison's women, the lives of his patients, were grotesque. That he felt he had no alternative did not make it less grotesque or cruel. And that didn't cover all of it, not by a long shot. It was because of Evie that he had to do all of it, and he realized suddenly, insane or not, he hated her for that. "Jeanette, whoever you—" "Don't bother me, Doc, I gotta do this. I want you to go out to the exercise yard." "What? I can't do that, at least not by myself, I can't. This is a prison, you know." She turned from him and peered into the shower. "Oh, now look, the man's gone. You scared him away." She gave a single dry sob. "What'll I do now?" "None of the doors are locked, sweetheart." Never in his life had Clint used such a term of intimacy when addressing an inmate, but now it came naturally, without thought. "I'll get on bad report if I do that."
"She's lost it, Doc,"
Angel said without looking up.
"Go on, Jeanette," Evie said. "Out to the furniture shop, across the exercise yard, into the garden. There are new peas there, as sweet as honey. Fill your pockets and come back. Dr. Norcross and I will be done by then, and we can have a picnic."
"A pee-pee picnic,"
Angel said through the screen of her hair, and snickered.
"Go on now," Evie said.
Jeanette eyed her uncertainly.
"The man may be out there," Evie coaxed. "In fact, I'm sure he is."
"Or possibly up your dirty ass,"
Angel said through her hair.
"He might be hiding there. Go find me a wrench and I'll help you find him."
"You've got a bad mouth, Angel," Jeanette said. "Bad."
She started up the short A-wing corridor, then stopped, staring fixedly down at a slanting oblong of sun on the floor, as if hypnotized.
"I say you can't not be bothered by a square of light," Evie said quietly.
Jeanette laughed and exclaimed,
"That's right, Ree. That's right. It's all lying for prizes, isn't it?"
She went on, step by slow step, weaving left and correcting, weaving right and correcting.
"Angel?" Evie said.
She spoke in that same quiet, courteous voice, but Angel looked up at once, seemingly wide awake.
"Dr. Norcross and I are going to have a brief consultation. You may listen, but you need to keep your mouth closed. If you don't,
I'll stop it up with a rat, and it will eat the tongue right out of your head.
Angel stared at her for several seconds, then lowered her face into her hands again. Officer Hughes showed up just as Clint was unfolding his chair outside Evie's cell.
Inmate just went outside, he said. Looked like she was headed for the garden. That okay?
It's fine, Scott. But keep an eye on her, would you? If she falls asleep out there, get her into the shade before she starts to grow a cocoon. We'll bring her in after she's completely wrapped.
Okay, boss.
Hughes sketched a salute and left.
Boss, Clint thought. Jesus God, boss. I wasn't nominated, I didn't campaign, but I got the job anyway.
Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown, Evie said. Henry IV, Part 2. Not one of his best, but not bad.
You know they had boys play the women's parts back then, right?
She is not a mind reader, Clint told himself. The men came just as she predicted, but I could have predicted that. It's simple logic. She's got the skills of a good carnival fortune teller, but she is not a mind reader.
Yes, and he could go on believing that as long as he liked. It was a free country.
Meanwhile, she was looking at him with curiosity and interest, eyes aware and totally awake. Probably the only woman alive who still looked like that.
What shall we talk about, Clint? Shakespeare's history plays? Baseball? The last season of Doctor Who? Too bad it ended on a cliffhanger, huh? I'm afraid it's reruns from here on out.
I have it on good authority that the doctor's companion fell asleep a couple of days ago, and now she's riding in a TARDIS through her own inner space.
Maybe they can recast, though. Go all male next season.
Sounds good, said Clint, automatically falling into shrink mode.
Or should we tackle something more germane to the current situation? I'd suggest the last, because time is getting short.
I'm interested in this idea you have about the two of us, Clint said. You being the woman and me being the man. Symbolic figures, archetypes, yin and yang. The king on one side of the chessboard, the queen on the other.
Oh, no, she said, smiling. We're on the same side, Clint. White king and white queen. On the other side, arrayed against us, is an entire army of black pieces. All the king's horses and all the king's men. Emphasis on men.
That's interesting that you see us on the same side. I didn't get that before. And when exactly did you begin to realize that?
The smile faded.
Don't. Don't you do it.
Don't do what?
Fall back on DSM-4.
To deal with this, you need to let go of certain rational assumptions and rely on intuition. Embrace your female side. Every man has one. Just think of all the male authors who have put on the dress. Mildred Pierce by James Cain, for example. That's a personal favorite.
There are a lot of female psychiatrists who would object to the idea that
when we spoke on the phone, while your wife was still awake, you believed what I was telling you. I could hear it in your voice.
I was in a strange place that night. Dealing with personal issues. Look, I'm not discounting your influence, your powers, however you want to characterize it. Let's assume you're in control, at least for today.
Yes, let's assume that. But tomorrow they may come for me. If not then, the next day, or the one after that, it won't be long. While in the other world, the one beyond the tree, time is moving at a much faster pace. Months are reeling by there. There are dangers, but with every one the women surmount, it becomes less likely that they will want to return to this world.
Let's say I understand and believe even half of what you're saying, Clint said. Who sent you?
President Reginald K. Dinkleballs,
Angel blurted from the neighboring cell.
Either him or Lord Herkimer Jerkimer, maybe.
Then she screamed. Clint turned in time to see a large brown rat scamper through the bars and into Angel's cell. She drew her feet up on the bunk and screamed again.
Get it out! Get it out! I hate rats!
Are you going to be quiet, Angel? Evie asked.
Yes! Yes! I promise! Yes!
Evie twirled her finger like an umpire signaling a home run.
The rat reversed out of Angel's cell and squatted in the corridor, watching her with beady eyes. Clint turned back to Evie. He'd had a series of questions in mind when he came down here, questions designed to make her face her delusions, but now they were blown away like a house of cards in a strong wind. I am the one with the delusions, he thought, holding on to them so I don't go completely insane. No one sent me, Evie said. I came on my own. Can we make a deal? He asked. We already have one, Evie said. If I live through this, if you save me, the women are free to decide their own course. But I warn you, the big guy, Geary, is very determined to have me. He thinks he can control the other men and capture me alive, but he's probably wrong about that. And if I die, it's over. What are you? He asked. Your only hope. I suggest you stop worrying about me and focus all your energies on the men outside these walls. They're the ones that need to concern you. If you love your wife and son, Clint, you need to work quickly to gain the upper hand. Geary isn't in complete control yet, but he will be soon. He's clever, he's motivated, and he doesn't trust anyone but himself. I put him off. Clint's lips felt numb. He has his suspicions, yes, but he can't be sure. He will be, once he talks to Hicks, and he's on his way there now. Clint rocked back on his chair as if she'd reached through the bars and slapped him. Hicks! He'd forgotten all about Hicks! Would he keep his mouth shut if Frank Geary questioned him about Eve Black? Balls, he would. Evie sat forward, her eyes locked on Clint's. I've warned you about your wife and son. I've reminded you that there are weapons you may be able to access, and those things are more than I should have done, but I didn't expect to like you so much. I suppose I might even be attracted to you because you're so damn foolhardy. You're like a dog barking at the ocean tide, Dr. Norcross. Not to get off the subject, but this is another aspect of the basic problem. The man-woman equation that never balances. Never mind. Subject for another time. You have a decision to make. Either prepare your defenses or clear out and let them have me. I'm not going to let them have you, Clint said. Big talk. Very macho. Her dismissive tone galled him. Does your all-seeing eye know I had to disable the payphones, Evie? That I kept every last woman here from saying goodbye to anyone, even to their children, because we couldn't risk letting word of you get out any further? That my own son is probably in danger, too? He's a teenage boy, and he's taking chances that I'm telling him to take. I know what you've done, Clint, but I didn't make you do anything. Clint was suddenly furious with her. If you believe that, you're lying to yourself. From the shelf, she took Hicks's phone. We're done here, Doctor. I want to play a few games of Boomtown. She dropped him the wink of a flirty teenager. I'm getting better all the time. 6. Here we are, Garth Flickinger said, and brought his battered Mercedes to a stop in front of the late Truman Mayweather's far more battered trailer. Michaela regarded it blankly. For the last few days, she'd felt like a woman in a dream, and the rusty trailer, up on blocks, surrounded by weeds and discarded auto parts, the police tape now lying on the ground and fluttering lackadaisically, seemed like just another of the peculiar turns dreams take. But I'm still here, she told herself. My skin is still my skin, right? She rubbed a hand up one cheek and across her forehead. Right. Still clean of cobwebs. Still here. Come on, Mickey, Garth said, getting out. If I find what I'm looking for, you'll be good to go for at least another day or two. She tried to open her door, couldn't find the handle, and simply sat there until Garth came around and opened it for her with an extravagant bow. Like a boy taking his date to the prom instead of to some shit-ass trailer in the woods where there was a recent double murder. Up's a daisy and out you come, Garth said, seizing her arm and pulling. He was bright and lively. Why not? He wasn't the one who'd been awake for over 100 hours. Since that night in the squeaky wheel, she and Garth had become fast friends. Or drug buddies, at least. He'd had a large bag of crystal meth, his emergency stash, he said, and that had balanced off the drinks nicely. She'd been happy enough to go home with him when the wheel finally ran out of booze and closed its doors. Under other circumstances, she might even have slept with him. As little as men did for her, sometimes the novelty was appealing, and God knew, the way things were going, she appreciated the company. Not under these circumstances, though. If she slept with him, she would really go to sleep after. She always did. And if she did that, whoopsie, there goes your ball game. Not that she had any idea if he would even be interested. Garth Flickinger did not present as the most sexual of beings, except in regards to dope, about which he was quite passionate. The emergency stash turned out to be sizable, and they had kept the party going at Garth's house for the better part of the next 48 hours. When he finally fell asleep for a few hours on Sunday afternoon, she had explored the contents of the doctor's roll-top desk. It contained, predictably, a stack of medical journals and several scorched drug pipes. Less expected was a creased photo of a baby wrapped in a pink blanket. Kathy was penciled lightly on the reverse side, and in the desk's bottom cabinet, a big box of reptile vitamin supplements. Next, she played with his jukebox. It held nothing but jam bands, unfortunately. She didn't need to listen to Casey Jones. She was well en route to becoming Casey Jones. Michaela flicked through what seemed like 500 channels on his El Gigantico TV, pausing only to watch those infomercials where the hucksters had the loudest, most offensive, listen-to-me-or-die voices. She seemed to remember ordering a Shark vacuum cleaner and having it sent to her old address in D.C. She doubted if it would arrive. Although it had been a man who took her call, Michaela was sure that it was women who actually filled the orders. Wasn't it usually the women who got those kinds of jobs? The crap jobs? If you see a toilet bowl without a ring, she thought, you know there's a woman somewhere in the vicinity. Troom told me he got hold of the best shit ever, and he wasn't lying, Garth said, leading her toward the trailer. I mean, don't get me wrong, he was a maniac, and he lied almost all the time, but this was the rare instance when he wasn't. The trailer had a hole in the side that was surrounded by a corona of what looked like dried blood, but surely that wasn't really there. She must be waking dreaming, quite common among people who had been without sleep for a long time. So said a self-proclaimed expert in a News America sidebar piece she'd seen before decamping for the green hills of her Appalachian hometown.
You don't see a hole in the side of that trailer, do you? She asked.
Even her voice was dreamlike now. It seemed to be issuing from a loudspeaker in the top of Michaela's head.
Yeah, he said. It's there, all right.
Listen, Mickey. Troom called this new stuff purple lightning, and I got a sample before the wild woman came on the scene and off Troom and his sidekick.
Garth was momentarily diverted into reverie.
The guy, he had the stupidest tattoo. That turd from South Park, the one that sings and stuff, it was on his Adam's apple. Who gets a turd tattoo on his Adam's apple? You tell me. Even if it's a witty, singing and dancing turd, it's still a turd. Everyone who looks at you sees a turd. Not my specialty, but I've consulted, and you would not believe what a pain it is to get something like that removed.
Garth, stop. Rewind. The wild woman. Is that the woman people in town are talking about? The one they're holding at the prison?
Uh-huh. She totally hulked out. I was lucky to get away. But that's water under the bridge, piss down the sewer pipe, last week's news, so on and so forth. Doesn't matter. And we should be grateful for that, trust me. What does matter is this superb crystal. Troom didn't make it. He got it from Savannah or somewhere. But he was going to make it, dig, analyze it, and then create his own version. He had a 2-gallon baggie of the shit, and it's in there somewhere. I'm gonna find it.
Michaela hoped so, because resupply was necessary. They had smoked up Garth's reserves over the last few days, even smoked up the rug bunnies and a couple of shards they'd found under the couch, Garth insisting that she brush her teeth after every session with the bong.
Because that's why meth addicts have such bad teeth, he'd told her. They get high and forget basic hygiene.
The stuff hurt her throat, and the euphoric effect had long since worn off, but it kept her awake. Michaela had been almost positive she would fall asleep on the ride out here. It had seemed interminable, but somehow she had managed to stay conscious. And for what? The trailer, balanced crooked on its cement blocks, didn't exactly look like the fountain of awareness. She could only pray that the purple lightning wasn't a fantasy of Garth Flickinger's dope-addled brain. "Go ahead," she said. "But I'm not going in with you. There might be ghosts." He looked at her with disapproval. "Mickey, you're a reporter. A news maven. You know there are no such things as ghosts." "I do know that," Michaela said from the loudspeaker on top of her head. "But in my current state, I might see them anyway." "I don't like leaving you on your own. I won't be able to slap you if you start nodding off." "I'll slap myself. Go get it. Just try not to be long." Garth trotted up the steps, tried the door, and put his shoulder to it when it wouldn't give. It flew open, and he stumbled inside. A moment later, he poked his head out the maroon-stained hole in the side of the trailer, a big grin on his face. "Don't go to sleep, you pretty thing. Remember, I'm gonna touch up your nose one of these fine days." "In your dreams, Buster," she said, but Garth had already pulled his head back inside. Michaela heard thuds and crashes as he began his search for the elusive purple lightning, which the cops had probably taken and stashed in the evidence locker at the sheriff's office, if they hadn't taken it home to their womenfolk. Michaela wandered to the ruins of the meth cooking shed. It was surrounded by charred bushes and blackened trees. No meth would be cooked here in the future, purple or otherwise. She wondered if the shed had blown up on its own, as meth cooking facilities were wont to do, or if the woman who had killed the cookers had blown it up. It was a moot question at this late date, but the woman herself interested Michaela, piqued the natural, seeking curiosity that had made her investigate Anton Dubček's dresser drawers when she was 8, and eventually led her into journalism, where you got to investigate everybody's drawers, those in their houses and those that they wore. That part of her mind was still active, and she had an idea it was keeping her awake as much as Flickinger's methamphetamine. She had cues with no A's. Cues like how this whole Aurora business got rolling in the first place, and why, assuming there was a why. Cues about whether or not the world's women could come back, as Sleeping Beauty had. Not to mention cues about the woman who had killed the meth dealers, and whose name was, according to some talk they'd overheard at the squeaky wheel and in town, either Eve or Evelyn or Ethelyn Black, and who could supposedly sleep and wake again, which made her like no other woman anywhere, unless another existed in Tierra del Fuego or the high Himalayas. This woman might only be a rumor, but Michaela tended to believe there was an element of truth to her. When rumors came to you from different directions, it was wise to pay attention. "If I wasn't living with one foot in reality and the other in the land of Nod," Michaela thought, starting up the path beyond the ruined meth shed, "I would hie myself to the women's prison and make some inquiries." Another cue. Who was running the place up there, now that her mother was asleep? Hicks? Her mother said he had the brain of a gerbil and the spine of a jellyfish. If memory served, Vanessa Lampley was the senior officer on the staff. If Lampley wasn't there anymore, or if she was snoozing, that left... Was that humming just in her head? She couldn't be completely sure, but she didn't believe so. She thought it was the power lines that ran near here, no big deal. Her eyes, however, were reporting stuff that was harder to dismiss as normal. Glowing splotches like handprints on some of the tree trunks a few feet from the blasted shed. Glowing splotches that looked like footprints on the moss and mulch, as if saying, "This way, m'lady." And clumps of moths on many of the branches, perched there and seeming to watch her. "Boo!" she shouted at one of these clumps. The moths fluttered their wings but did not take off. Michaela slapped one side of her face, then the other. The moths were still there. Casually, Michaela turned and looked down the slope toward the shed and the trailer below. She expected to see herself lying on the ground, wrapped in webs, undeniable evidence that she had disconnected from her body and become a spirit. There was nothing, though, except for the ruins and the faint sounds of Garth Flickinger treasure hunting his ass off. She looked back up the